Finance Committee come to order. It's about 9:05 on the 8th day of March, 2011. We have members present, Representative Guttenberg, Representative T. Wilson, Vice Chair Faircloth Saltz, Representative Dugan, Representative Israel, Representative Costello, and Representative Newman. We have a quorum to do business. Anything to come before the committee before we start our daily order? Seeing none, we have three bills before us, House Bills 13, House Bill 126, and House Bill 80. We're going to endeavor to move 13 and 126 out, and House Bill 80, we'd like to have a public hearing on that issue. There's certainly been a lot of interest on both sides of the issue, so we don't have time to do that this morning, and we haven't given adequate notice to the public. It has been properly noticed, but I don't think we've given adequate notice for a public hearing, so following as much process as we can. That's our intent today. So I'm going to bring up House Bill 13 first. Representative Olson, and anybody you care to wish to bring with you? Welcome.
Thank you, Co-Chair Stoltz. I appreciate you giving us the opportunity to hear the bill during a very busy week we'll be having. House Bill 13 has been a work in progress for the last few years. A previous version of this bill died on the last night of the 26th legislature. Basically, the director was set in place, expired on December 31st of last year, and the administration, by emergency regulation, extended it 6 months, so we're under the clock on this bill. Today with me, I have Conrad Jackson of my staff, who's put a tremendous amount of work into this bill, and Linda Hall, the director of the Division of Insurance, who has worked with us for, I believe, almost 3 years on this for previous forms and extensions. We also have people from the Department of Labor online or in the room, and I'd like to turn it over to Linda Hall. And again, thank you for hearing this bill today.
Welcome, Director Hall.
Thank you. For the record, Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. This morning I'd like to talk a little bit about the bill and the reason for fee schedule. As Representative
really.
He's not the most memorable chair.
With this kind of chair, I really
can. I can only go up from here.
With that, continue. There was an expectation in 2007 that after the inadvertent deletion of the fee schedule, that the stakeholders would propose legislation. That really didn't happen. So we have, over the course of time, done three provisions that merely did a cost of living type increase to the fee schedule. And in that process, while we were doing a cost of living increase, we were not keeping the fee schedule up to date with procedure codes. So today there's probably 2,000 procedure codes that are not even covered by the fee schedule. It seems rather amazing that there can be that many new procedure codes, but apparently with bundling and unbundling and new services. So our fee schedule not only is behind in terms of the structure, it's also very behind. There are some charts in your bill packet I'd like to just quickly refer to, just as kind of an indication of what is happening with medical fees in Alaska in the workers' compensation arena. The first one, it's one of these colored charts. The first one is titled Medical Benefits Constitute the Majority.
And
the
before we go, I'd like the clerk to identify this for the record as from the Department of Labor, Division of Workers' Comp. It's an important aspect for me to make sure everything that's in these bill folders be identified from the source. So please proceed.
Okay. The graph, the pie charts show the total medical costs in Alaska are 75% of the system costs. So, for example, every dollar that's spent in the system, 75% of that is spent on medical costs. countrywide, that same average is 58%. So we're significantly higher than the countrywide. We're somewhat higher than even the regional average. But a great portion of our workers' compensation cost is due to the high cost of medical care. The second graph from the National Council on Compensation Insurance is titled Alaska Medical Average Cost Per Case Versus Countrywide. And I'm just going to talk about 2009. As you can see, the average cost in Alaska for a work comp case is $37,000. The average cost countrywide is $27,000. That's about a 37% differential. So the costs, again, that we're paying for workers' compensation medical fees are a large portion of the system cost, and we need to do some restructuring of this fee schedule. The third attachment that's in your packet is the Oregon Workers' Compensation Premium Rate Ranking. I've used this, I believe, in hearings with many of you in earlier years. I was very excited when this year's study came out. We are no longer number one. We had been number one for four successive years, having the highest workers' compensation premium rates in the country, which I don't think is a good sign for our labor, for our economy. So we are now at least number two. We are moving down. We have had rate decreases for the last 5 years, some more extensive than others. And with that, I would just kind of like to talk a little about the general overview and the provisions. It's a very short bill. So we really are looking to replace those CPI indexes of the past with a sustainable schedule that we are not in front of the legislature every year or every year and a half asking for a CPI increase. As I indicated earlier, we would provide a full fee schedule that includes all of the missing procedure codes, and really it is a step back to the methodology that was in place in 2004. We would carry forward with the way the fee schedule has been promulgated since that time. Fee schedule is adopted by the Workers' Compensation Board, but it is constructed by an outside vendor who collects data. They collect data based on geographical areas, so the fee schedule is a base fee schedule that is not to exceed the usual, reasonable, and customary fees as established by the board. The fee schedule is based on a credible profile of billed charges so that it's actuarially credible. It reflects the cost differences for geographical areas. They're done basically by zip codes. There are four geographical areas in Alaska today where fees are grouped. And this bill not only puts the fee schedule back in place for the board to approve, but it also kind of expands the categories. So we make sure that we're picking up all of the types of medical services that are provided that would be included in this new schedule, including transportation costs. Some transportation costs, emergency costs such as medevacs, have become extremely expensive. You may have heard from constituents. I have a number of anecdotal cases on my desk of both in health insurance arena and in workers' compensation, of the extremely high cost of medevacs and ground transportation in certain cases. So this also will bring those into the fee schedule. I don't think it will necessarily reduce them. I would also add there's, as a final note, one of the other things I think we do here is we make sure the fee schedule is based on the 90th percentile of bill charges. That's higher than most medical health insurance fee schedules. So I think that ensures that even with this fee schedule, our injured workers will be able to have good treatment. Their doctors will take them and treat them. They won't be prohibited from obtaining medical services. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Linda, I have a couple of questions. First off, what is the effect on employers and their insurance costs if this bill is to go forward? We hear a lot from employers about their high cost of insurance, a large part of that being the cost for unemployment and workers' comp. How would this affect employers' insurance fees?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I think this puts a stability to the fee schedule. It will, I don't think it will particularly reduce costs, but I think it has the potential to cap cost. Today, with the 2000 procedure codes that we are not covering in our fee schedule, all those procedure codes are paid at 100% because there is no, they're not included in the fee schedule. So those would be capped at the 90th percentile in that process. So there is a potential for a small increase, but I think the stability that we're building in with a sustainable fee schedule is beneficial to the system and the system costs.
Would it seem, if I may, Mr. Chair, would seem to me on that issue that that stability will help bring more insurance companies into the state of Alaska with more, maybe some competition on our, for insurance companies, help stabilize their costs, I'm hoping. When you looked at your fee charges, did you go through the physician's board on these and have them look at this? Or fees
I'm sorry,
on
I can't hear you, Representative.
Did you consult the physician's board or board physicians on your medical fee charges on this? Are we going to hear something from our physicians on this?
They operate through the chair. The physicians operate today under a fee schedule. They have reviewed this bill. This bill is identical to a bill that passed the House last year, and I think we made some changes in the language in response to concerns from the medical society, and I've not heard those concerns this year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any other questions?
I notice North Dakota is beating us on another thing here for the cheapest premiums. In the oil industry is pretty active there, and all farm implements and everything else. It seems like that'd be a dangerous place. But what are they doing? You don't have it. It's the least visited state, so you may not have been there to find out. Any other questions for Director Hall, of a serious or otherwise nature? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, on the fee scheduling and the capping, has there been an analysis of what happens to the providers with cost shifting? Is their charges going to go up in other places? We're capping what they can charge. You know, we know that there's a lot of situations where whether it's Medicaid or any other services that are provided, and there's costs that are shifted. Has there been analysis of what happens?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. The cost, I don't know. I would say, first of all, I'll answer your question. No, I don't believe there's been analysis. The National Council on Compensation Insurance, who is our statistical agent and does various kinds of analysis, has not done that particular thing. But I would say today when the fee schedule is constructed at the 90th percentile, I don't think there would be any significant cost shifting that would occur, such as the Medicare or Medicaid rates may be lower, and they're lower than the actual cost to provide the service. So I would not anticipate that there would be any cost shifting of any significance, at least.
Questions? Hearing none, we'll go to, you have any follow-ups, Representative?
We'll see if there's anybody in the audience. We have Mr. Monagle from the Department of Labor. Did you have any testimony, or is it for questions only? Is there anybody else in the audience here that wanted to testify on the bill? Anybody on the teleconference network? We'll go ahead and close public testimony. If somebody, we will reopen it if there's something germane. We'll go to the fiscal note issue. a $75,000 fiscal note.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Mike Monagle. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. There is a $75,000 cost associated with producing a medical fee schedule. This is based on information that we received from the last contractor that we used, which was Ingenix, back in 2003. So it's an estimate on what it would take to produce the fee schedule envisioned by the bill.
And what did the previous fee schedule cost you to produce?
To the chair, unfortunately, we're not able to find that information. As I say, it's been almost 10 years since the last fee schedule was produced. I asked our administrative support people to give me a copy of our last time we did this in 2003, and they were not able to find that information. This is why we contacted Ingenix and asked them to give us a general quote on what it would cost to produce. We couldn't get into great details on exactly how we would bid this out because we anticipate they would be a bidder on any contract that we put out a request for proposals. So, but that is their general estimate on what other charges to other states have been.
That's just kind of surprising. The workman's comp was not a low-profile issue in 2003 and 2004. And, a little surprising. Probably, I guess we'll trust you on this one unless there's any objections. But tell Click we're always happy with the work they're doing, and he's not disappointing us. That was sarcastic. Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I know that we've been going through a process to try to make the fiscal notes that come before the committee a little bit more relevant and require additional information, and I'm not sure that the answer we received meets the hurdle that we've tried to make each fiscal note jump over to date. I'm wondering whether we should zero out 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17 so the department has to come back to us with an actual figure, passing the bill with and letting it go this year. But anyway, just throwing that out.
I think that's a good compromise for a lack of information. So I'll take that as a motion.
So moved.
Is there any objection? Representative Bugle?
Just for a question, Mr. Chairman.
Did you still hear it? Did he run for it?
Oh.
Would you like me to come forward?
Yeah, please.
Mr. Monagle.
I'm sorry. I just have a quick question. I agree with Representative. I'm sorry. So the motion here is to zero this out after the first year. And my question is, will the first year provide the information for us that where we can then look at a more complete fiscal note than we seem to be able to ask?
Through the chair, yes.
Okay.
I believe they will. We do have to go out through a competitive bid process. And I think the first time we do this, right now we have a request for information out for vendors to notify us so we can get an idea of which vendors are in the market to provide this data. But after our first contract award, I think we'll have a solid idea of what the costs will be.
Great, thank you.
It'll be at least $75,000 is what I guess.
Mr. Chairman, I remove my objection if I actually make
it. Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, and just for the record that we're establishing here, the negative part could be that it's more expensive, recognizing that. And so I do recognize that when we go out for bid, it could come in less, which is hopeful, but it also could be higher. Thank you.
This one's adopted. We have a question. We have members of Representative Guerra.
Thanks.
And we've had Representative Jewell, Representative Guerra, and Representative Thomas all join us.
Thank you. I have no problem with the bill, but just a comment to the committee, which is not only in workers' comp are medical costs high, but across the board in Alaska, medical costs are high in many, many areas. And there has been some information that I've been given that I've always wanted to find out whether it is true, and it might be worth a hearing at some point. It might help us on Medicaid. It might help us in general on other state costs. But that while most states allow insurance compensation at the 50th percentile, at the average, Alaska has a special statute allowing insurance compensation at the 70th percentile. And people always ask, how come insurance or medical costs are so much higher here than everywhere else? I don't know if that's part of the answer. I don't know if I'm going to have the medical community all over me for saying what I just said. But it might be worth some questions as we look at the Medicaid issue, as we look at sort of the high cost of medical care in Alaska in the future. So that would be my request at some point if we have some downtime.
Any other questions to the committee? Thank you, Mr. Martin. Are there any amendments? Hearing none. I think are any other questions on the bill? Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I move from committee House Bill number 1327-LS0104/A with amended fiscal note and individual committee recommendations.
Is there any objection? Hearing no objections, that bill moves out of committee. Thank you, Representative Olson, Director Hall, and others. We'll jump right into the next bill. Invite, while we're signing the committee report, go ahead and get ready to present your bill, Ms. Daldish. We'll just take a brief at ease. Welcome back to order. We have before us House Bill 126. We have a Finance Committee substitute, which amends the omnibus sunset extension bill. The substance of the change is that it removes the RCA and the Alcohol Beverage Control Board from this sunset omnibus bill, and that's subjective decision to deal with those larger, more policy-oriented agencies in separate bills. But we have the CS, Representative Fairclough, can you move the CS?
Mr. Chairman, I move before the committee the CS for House Bill number 126, Finance, 27-LS0321/I, dated 3-1-11.
Are there any objections to the adoption of this CS? Hearing none, the CS is before us. Ms. Dalbridge.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Rena Dalbridge, staff to Representative Hawker. He, as LBNA chairman, supports the omnibus extension. He sends his apologies for not being here with you this morning. Whatever questions you might have on the CS, he believes that the omnibus is the most efficient mechanism for routine board and commission extensions. And we have Pat Davidson here, legislative auditor, to ask any questions as far as the audit recommendations on those sunset extensions.
It's we normally had all these fairly non-controversial sunsets in front of us one at a time with individual sponsors. Well, let's go ahead and invite Ms. Davidson up so we can go through the routine on the audit recommendations. And we'll take questions anytime through the process.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Just probably not worth the comment, but given the given that this has been narrowed down to the very non-controversial extensions, I don't know that we, I personally don't need the verbal review of the reports that are already in the file, but maybe other people do.
Well, so the public's watching, so that's part of the process, but we will probably don't go through the in-depth with others, but just make a confirmation on the record that of the audit committee, excuse me, this is a statutory required process. Ms. Davidson, if you start with the first board, if you just go through.
For the record, Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. Limiting my comments to just those occupational boards that are included in the Finance Committee, CS. There was one recommendation that was made to each of those boards, and it has to do with making timely investigations. We are finding that while health and safety issues are being dealt with first, there is long periods of inactivity associated with investigations of complaints for the other boards. Getting into the board specifically, the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, we found that their financial status is generally okay. However, we did make a recommendation that the public member of the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers should either resign from the board or surrender her hairdressing license. Public members are not supposed to be engaged in the profession over which they're regulated. This person indicated they were no longer an active hairdresser, but when you read the statute, one of those two things should actually happen. For the Board of Dental Examiners, other than the timely investigations, we made no recommendations. However, the board has been running a surplus, and fees were reduced during the FY09 renewal cycle, which should drop down their accumulated surplus and get them back to a more break-even level. And then the third board was the Board of Nursing. The Board of Nursing actually had three specific recommendations. One was to recommend that the appropriate entities be notified when advanced nurse practitioner's authority to write prescriptions had been revoked or suspended by the board. We found that the Board of Nursing needed to improve its oversight of certified nurses' aid training programs. We found that their on-site reviews were being done sporadically, but there was no processing or review of the self-evaluation forms that were being submitted biannually by the CNA training programs. And lastly, the individual appointed to the licensed practical nurse, the LPN position on the board, does not meet the statutory qualifications. According to the statute, that board position is to be held by an LPN working in an institutional nursing situation, and the current board member is working as an emergency medical technician and therefore does not meet the statutory requirements for that position. When we looked at the financial status of the Board of Nursing, it has built up a substantial surplus. This is the results of past accounting errors. And in its response to the audit, the department as well as the board indicated that they planned on dropping fees maybe by 20% in the FY11, FY12 renewal cycle.
We're going to have Mr. Habiger address some of those issues and how they were represented.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only question I have is when you have these two people who need to do something, how long do you give them to like fill this position for somebody to resign and fill it differently? Is there a time limit?
Thank you, Chair. Representative Wilson, while we make recommendations, we don't have the ability to enforce them, and so we are looking for the division, once it's identified as an issue, to take the necessary corrective action.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Davidson on the audit issues? Oh, Representative Garrett.
Yeah, it was my fault for wanting to speed through this when I was wrong. So are we going to hear from the boards where the recommendations are that the members resign? Because that's our only power to have them resign, is to have the boards tell us they're going to do that. All we can do is authorize the board or not authorize the board.
We're going to have Mr. Haberger come before us, and he represents the administration, so, and oversees those boards. So we can. That's probably the pertinent place to ask that. Any other questions for the sponsors, Representative or Ms. Davidson? Oh, Representative Fairfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering whether it would be appropriate to ask Representative Hawker to issue a letter on behalf of the Finance Committee and Legislative Audit requesting compliance and to bring that information back to this body no later than next year. Or no later than the end of session, if we believe as a finance committee that this needs to be complied with in the next 30 days, then we could ask Representative Hawker on behalf of the legislature to ask the chairman of these boards for compliance. And we would know prior to the end of session or before we took the omnibus bill to the floor whether they were in compliance or not.
And we'll look at that at the end of the meeting. We'll see what Mr. Haberger says. He may have a stiff broom. I don't know. Well, thank you, Ms. Davidson. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Ms. Davidson, the exemption from 4466050E, can you tell us a little bit about why the prohibition exists to begin with? And that is more establishing more than one board or commission or extending it.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. Other than the statute talks about the fact that no bill should have more than one board extension associated with it, I don't really know the history.
Okay. I do recall during a bill debate, former Representative Nelson read a bill title that had, I think, about 12 or 15 board extensions in the title. So that was prior to me being in the legislature. Historically, so she dug that one up and read it on the floor during debate on another issue on a single subject. That's just anecdotal, and that's certainly not a substantive answer. Thank you, Ms. Davidson. Mr. Haberger.
For the record, my name is Don Haberger, and I'm Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. Mr. Chair, to I think the question of Representative Guttenberg, I think, and it's been a while, and I recall that situation has already been corrected as far as the switch on the Barbers and Hairdressers Board. I believe that license, if I'm not mistaken, has been already surrendered, and thus compliance is achieved. Was it Representative Jarrah? Sorry about that. I will double-check on that. Certainly heard the wishes of the committee on getting that situation rectified. I'll get back to you with an affirmative answer on that particular issue. As far as I think some of the other issues that were discussed and concerns raised here, in specific, as far as investigations is concerned, we are certainly aware of that. Each and every legislative audit mentioned that specific issue. We are working diligently to try to correct that. Some of the things that the ledge audit did point out is we had an old database that was not functioning as well as it should. It did not have a mechanism to flag older cases. We spent a little bit of resources on coming up with a new product from a national organization that has databases for licensing activities across the nation. This new product has been installed. We're still going through the learning curve. We'll still, well, we've already transferred one record, our database into the new database. But as is with any launch, we're still going through some of that cleaning up process. We think we're going to get where the committee wants to go in the end and have timely investigations, and we hope by next year we can report that these things are a thing of the past. Can't remember if there were any other burning issues, Mr. Chair, but there are
nurses, fees.
Nurses' fees? Yes, we are aware of, I think, end of FY10, it was $1.4 million roll forward. And when we review the fee annually, we certainly do make adjustments. There have been a number of fees that I've had the opportunity to already review, and some of these have gone up, some of these have remained the same. And when there are surpluses, and we can use those surpluses to amortize, I guess, the licensing fees, then they are reduced.
Representative Newman and Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Havinger, I believe I'm going to talk about the Board of Nursing and some of the issues that I believe, if memory serves me correctly, LBNA, where it was a nurse practitioner who was writing prescriptions, I believe that weren't appropriate, or she didn't have her license, and the lack of the ability of the Board of Nursing to regulate that or to deal with that issue. Do you know about that issue?
I'm familiar with one case that the division has worked through recently, and in this particular instance, that was correct. There were actions brought against the individual, and the division did take licensing action. Some of those reporting issues, I know that the chair of the board and myself and the board's executive director is dealing with a way to get the word out to more folks. There is already a licensing action page, if you will, on the state's database for the Board of Nursing, but we're trying to expand getting that word out.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. And also, Mr. Havinger, the finding by Ledge Budget and Audit that they have positions on that board that are inappropriately filled. I don't know how you're dealing with that, but you know, it's my sense that if we've got several issues concerning the Board of Nursing, you know, we're looking at an 8-year extension on here, maybe that we don't have a lot of authority. Maybe we should, I'm considering, you know, maybe trying to reduce that a little bit to bring it back in front of this committee, at least so we do look at some of these issues a little that are important because they are medical. It deals with some pretty important issues, but I'm trying to weigh my confidence in your ability to deal with them, but I think we're okay on it. But how are we going to deal with the positions that aren't filled appropriately with the right people?
Through the chair, Representative Newman. I'm sorry. I know we had the issue with the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, but I don't recall off the top of my head issue with the Board of Nursing licenses. However, more generally, in response to that question, we have 20-some boards that we deal with, and I would agree with you insofar as at times it's a challenge to keep track of our 129 various board members. But I do note the concern, and I will put that on my radar scope at this point.
How much of this is a hangover from a former administration and a former board of commissions director?
Mr. Chair, I'm...
Send the signals, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of a follow-up, because number four was the director of boards should fill the LPN position with an LPN currently involved in institutional nursing services. And they said it, I guess this person does emergency. And I guess my request is that when that is corrected, if you could have to send us a letter, give us some kind of notification that that has been fulfilled, we'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you. Once we reapprove the board, we have no authority to get you to replace that that one member who Ms. Davidson said is serving inappropriately. So how quickly can you get back to us on your course of action for removing that member or confirming for us that Ms. Davidson is incorrect, one or the other?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. These are appointed through the governor's office, and I will work with them on these appointments. But more germane to, I guess, the question is, I think this issue also was taken care of shortly after the ledger audits came out, but I will confirm both of those now that you've reminded me of the other one and get back to the committee as quickly as I can.
And on the eight-year extension, no member of this body or the other body is prohibited from introducing a bill on any one of these issues. These are the sunset reviews. They're just often a convenient time to make those changes, but any time there's a perceived or real dysfunction, any member can introduce legislation, or you don't even have to have a reason to introduce a bill, as I've seen around here. So this is not an eight-year prohibition from dealing with the issue. Representative Guerra.
Mr. Haberger is going to get back in touch with us about whether or not this inappropriate member is still serving. I guess I would like to hear from Ms. Davidson whether she's comforted too. I would like for you to coordinate with Ms. Davidson so we can hear from her too whether she feels the concern has been addressed.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, understood.
And certainly the governor's office is the ultimate... Not this whole loop here. They're the ones that can make this substantive change. Any other questions? Thank you both. Let's see. Are there any amendments? Any of these? Representative Faircloth.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have an amendment, but we do have a way to get the attention that people are wanting to do. We can zero the fiscal note. And change it on the floor if we have the appropriate answers before we're doing it. We don't need to be at that harsh. We certainly can move it forward and ask our rules chair to hold it till we have the answers to the questions for reauthorization. So we have multiple tools at our disposal to get the answers to the questions that we want.
I'm comfortable with sending the fiscal notes forward as they are. This is a pretty mild sunset review, considering what we've gone through in the last few years on these and some of the dysfunctions and the hair wringing we've gone through. This is a pretty mild presentation, not acceptable as our final product, but I think we've gone a long way in boards and commissions. And not saying that Mr. Haberger is ready to put his feet up on the desk yet, but I do think. Well, this is actually refreshing that these are the only issues we're dealing with on boards and commissions. It's substantive ones, but all seemingly solvable. But it's a breath of change from what we've seen in just most recent years. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I should just say for the record that my expectation is that before this bill goes to the floor, we're going to have affirmative answers, I guess is the way I would phrase it, on these questions from Mr. Haberger, and then we'll be able to send it forward in the normal course of events.
We can convey that position to the rules chairman, not to schedule this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that, because I'm not expecting any problems, but problems happen sometimes. Thank you.
Is that, Ms. Dalbridge, is that an acceptable course of action as the representative sponsor?
Excuse me. We'd be happy to follow up that way and to respond to Representative Faircloth and other concerns and find a way to ensure that we can get audit recommendations followed through on.
That'll make the House floor debate a lot more comfortable and maybe non-existent. With that, Representative Faircloth.
Mr. Chairman, I move from committee to CS for House Bill 126 Finance 27-LS0321/I, dated 3-1-11, with attached fiscal notes and individual committee recommendations.
Jack, for discussion.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The two controversial ones that are not in here are the RCA, which when I first started as a legislator, seemingly took up like a quarter of the session, and then the ABC board. So do we have an assurance that those agencies sunset, I believe, this year, and so we're just going to make sure that we'll get a vote on those agencies before the end of the session?
I don't know that I call them controversial. I call them more substantive regulatory agencies. There have been some controversies in over the past decade and a half involving some of the activities, but I don't have any tricks up my sleeve on the agenda at this point. There are other issues involving them that there should be full debate on all of them in this committee. That's just, I think it would have been a short shrift to have included, with no disrespect to the barbers and hairdressers, the RCA and the ABC, in the same fell swoop of the non-controversial board. So we want both those on the docket as quick as we can get them, get over this pesky budget and oil tax bill, and we can clear a lot of lumber out of this yard.
Fair enough. Thanks.
Hearing no other objections, the bill moves to the committee. We'll take just a in-place recess. Our last bill of the day, which we don't intend to move out today, and we're going to have this before us at a future day for more extensive public hearing and public testimony. So with that, welcome Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mark Newman, House District 15, the beautiful Susitna River Valley. Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 80, Alaska statutes already recognize that we have a right to use deadly force to protect our family, person, and property. But HB 80 also further clarifies that right exists not only in our home, but also in any place we have a right to be. This legislation clarifies an individual's rights to stand their ground and not second-guess the consequences of protecting our family and life. HB 80 also strengthens the legal recognition of a human basic right to defend oneself by sending a message that it is the criminal who has the duty to retreat. 18 states have already introduced duty to retreat, no duty to retreat legislation or stand your ground legislation, and there is a list of those states in your packet along with some of their suggested language. We followed pretty much along those lines with those suggestions on this, and tried to make it as simple and straightforward as we could, and I'm here to answer any questions that we have, Mr. Chair.
And we're not going to get real deep in here today, but I probably just we'll have a general discussion. If folks have folks they would like to have testify on the bill is from agencies or organizations, let me know that as quick as you can. And with that, we'll go to a couple rounds of questions. Representative Wilson, Guerra, and then Faircliff.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Some of the emails I have still believe that this bill forces people to retreat. You're saying that it does not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, Alaska statutes currently state that there is a duty to retreat. If you're in a situation where you may use deadly force, again, our statutes say that there is a duty to retreat, and those are being second-guessed in the judicial systems. This puts it back into the hands of the person who is at that incident to try and make those split-second decisions and protect their rights.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
I'm trying to kind of interpret what you just said. So you would still, have a requirement to try to retreat first in your mind, or you can literally stand your ground and not have to worry so much about whether you're going to be prosecuted. Mine wants, just so you know where I'm coming from, because I'm not trying to you know, sideswipe this or anything. People in my district don't want to have to try to make the decision in an emergency case where should I retreat or should I stand my ground. They want to be able to do what I think this bill does and be able to take care of their family first. But are we not changing the part of the statute that says you still have to retreat?
Press 0. To enter a breakout session, press 1.
Please. Did you get that, Representative Newman?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Through the Chair, Representative Wilson. Again, there is a justification clause in statutes that state very specifically how self-defense can be applied. But our statutes are somewhat vague in the fact that they do say that there is a duty to retreat in those statutes. And what is that duty to retreat? And that's a question that probably the person at that incident, that scene, has to try and follow through. There's a lot of different instances we could try and come up with and what ifs and what haves, but and of course we'll ultimately decide those anyhow. But we're just trying to make sure we have clarified language that you have the right to stand your ground if you feel you need to have to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Guerra from Fairclough.
Thanks. Representative Newman, I think I ended up voting for this bill last year, but I forgot how some of it worked. So, first of all, on the duty to retreat, you never have a duty to retreat if you can't do so safely, right? So the law says right now you only have a duty to retreat if you can do so perfectly safely to yourself and others. So it's not like you have a duty to retreat and endanger yourself by doing it. If we say you don't have a duty to retreat in a safe circumstance when the person is in any place where the person has the right to be, then under what circumstances can you shoot somebody? I mean, there's got to be some standard. I don't want to give somebody the right to shoot somebody just because they want to shoot somebody. So where's the standard that says when you can't shoot somebody?
Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, in the justification clauses of when you can use deadly force, leaving your packet, under 1181.330, it specifically states several times of when you can legally defend yourself. The person using force with mutual combat, through death, serious physical injury, kidnapping, sexual assault in the second degree, abuse of a minor, and robbery in the third degree. But it also states that a person may not use deadly force in this section. A person knows that with complete personal safety and complete safety as to others being defended, the person can avoid the necessity of using deadly force by leaving the area. Is there, you know, to try and pick out a specific instance of when or when you cannot, that's an interpretation, I think, for the judicial branch, but we're just trying to clarify that if you have a legal right to be someplace, you have the right to not be second-guessed to defend yourself.
Thanks, through the Chair. And maybe at some point we'll have to hear from the Department of Law. But right now it's sort of circular. I mean, under current law, you have a duty to not shoot somebody if you can, with perfect personal safety, withdraw. And this is changing it so that if you're in a place where you have a legal right to be, that you can shoot somebody even though you're in perfect personal safety. That's the way it reads. So there must be some other standard in some other statute, and you mentioned 030, but we don't have 030 in front of us, that has the other circumstances where you're not allowed to shoot somebody. I just want to make sure that we have some fair standards so this isn't like the Wild West, and so that you have a right. You don't want to give somebody the right to shoot somebody for no good reason. And I want to make sure we have some definition of that somewhere.
Representative Newman, can you make sure when you come back you have the materials you're reading from for everybody else, and we'll drill into this a little deeper.
Just for clarification, my name is Chair. Again, we are not trying to attempt to change any of the justification clauses that are there. You have to be fully justified for using deadly force. And then we can, we'll get, make sure that you've got copies of that.
That's the 030 somewhere.
Okay.
And we will Department of Law, Department of Public Safety, and other groups will be active participants in this at the table. And that's, well, we are, I expect to hear from the troopers, the Department of Public Safety, Ms. Carpinetti, and they'll all be before us. So,
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to hear from the Public Defender's Office.
Mr. Steiner is actually online, but we're going to try to get prepared for the Finance Committee later this afternoon. This is just the initial hearing on this bill. Just let the public know what's laid out there, but this will take a couple of hearings minimum. Representative Fairclough and then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe what you asked the committee members to do is provide you input on what we might want to see at future hearings. So looking at the fiscal note, I'm interested from the Department of Law. They're proposing two new full-time attorney positions that they believe will be necessary to support the implementation of this particular piece, and I'm wondering if they have information from other areas of jurisdiction that showed an increase somewhere that would support this particular fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Newman, I'm not sure if this makes life safer or more complex, but are there specific instances where this bill, had it been in place, would have changed some situation? If there was a shooting, that would have happened. I mean, there was if this bill in place would have changed the outcome. Somebody would have said, "Oh, we passed the bill now. Now I can shoot. I don't have to withdraw."
Chair, Representative Guttenberg, I don't know if I don't think that there would be changes in past convictions. I think, is that what your question is? Of how this would affect it, a homicide case or how somebody pleaded in that case if this was enacted. So I'm not quite sure the question. I think you're asking me if this would go back and allow somebody to use this legislation to try and, I don't know.
I'm trying to figure out if there was the need for this, whether there's specific incidents that happen where brought you to the point, well, you know, either reading an article in the paper or somebody discussing it with you personally, if I didn't have the duty to retreat, I would have been safer. The outcome would have been more positive for myself and my family. And that's what I'm looking for.
And you can come back with any follow-up to that. And I'm certainly going to be talking to the Department of Law. One of the things, I think one of the intuitive things of this bill is there'll be less prosecutions because you won't have a wayward public prosecutor, maybe just freshly minted out of some East Coast law school, looking and having their own agenda, and not understanding the Alaska way of life up here, and that would certainly you probably wouldn't need a public defender, but. I'm a little bit puzzled by the fiscal notes, but we'll drill into those. It's the whole point of this is to have less prosecutions self-defense. But that's Representative Wilson and Fairclough.
Just a follow-up on Representative Guttenberg, sir. They based this fiscal note on 1,155 cases in 2010. I would be interested to know which ones of those that they may have seen would have fallen into if a bill had been like that, and I think that's kind of what Representative Guttenberg was trying to get to. You know, are there cases out there that were prosecuted that if this bill had been, there may not have been? But I would like to know how that 1,155 is relevant to their fiscal note.
We'll let the Department of Public Safety and Department of Law tell us that. Representative Fairclough?
Sure, yes. The sponsor could provide us a definition for self-defense in Alaska state statute. It might clear up some of the issues where people think that this is somehow creating more harm than good. It's an act related to self-defense, so it's already outlined what a person should be doing.
Any other charges for Representative Newman before we put this aside for today? And certainly to let my office and Representative Newman, Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know in the state we have a right to conceal, to carry concealed weapons, and I'm totally fine with that. What does this do to the person who doesn't have the permit to conceal but is in a place where he has a right to be and is carrying?
We have,
and then self-defense occurs.
We have a permitless. We have a dual system now, a permit and a right for every Alaskan to carry, barring certain circumstances. So, but Representative Newman, can you flesh out that question as well? As
right now.
Okay. But,
to the chair.
Why don't you, go
ahead. The justification clause in the National Security Act, if you don't have a legal right to have a handgun, then you can't use it to for deadly force, you know, to protect yourself if you don't have the right to already have that gun. In Alaska now, we don't have to have a concealed handgun permit, because there's instances, if you're a felon or other instances where you don't have a right to carry a gun and you use it, you're already acting illegally, and this does not protect that right.
Seeing no other questions, we're going to set this bill aside. This portion of finance will adjourn for today. Representative Thomas will be reconvening the meeting to deal with. We have two bills up. Let's see. We have our operating budget, mental health budget up today. So we'll adjourn this meeting, and House Finance Committee will reconvene for the second hearing at 1:30 today. That we're adjourned.